This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the program, stories from the notebooks of two veterans of the Chicago Police Department. We'll talk with them about what it's like to be a cop in the big city. Gina Gallo and Dennis Banahan are our guests. Both are retired officers who are now writing. Gallo is the author of a memoir, Armed and Dangerous. Banahan is the author of the novel, Threshold of Pain. Together, they write a column for the online magazine, Blue Murder. Gina Gallo also writes columns for New York Cop Online and thecolumnists.com. Gina Gallo was a Chicago police officer for 16 years, from 1982 to 1998. She worked in uniform and undercover. Dennis Banahan was a police officer in Chicago for 30 years, from 1969 to 1999. When Lieutenant Banahan retired, he was tactical coordinator of the Gresham Police District. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guests this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Gina Gallo, Dennis Banahan, good afternoon. Thanks.
Thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
Hi. I would like to ask both of you this question to start. What's your definition of a good cop?
Go ahead, G, you're in.
Ladies first. I think a good cop is somebody, this is a definition that was given to me when I was in the academy, and it was given to all of us in our beginning days. A good cop is someone who goes out at the beginning of his eight-hour tour of duty and is there to back up his partner and anyone else who needs him, protecting themselves and the public, and coming back home alive and intact.
Hmm. Dennis Banahan, you want to add anything to that?
No, basically, I probably agree with the same definition. A good policeman is a guy that goes out there and does an honest day's work, and he's out there to protect the citizens and to help in whatever situation he can.
Yeah. Well, assuming that everyone who joins the department does so to serve and protect, what leads some cops off that path?
Well, I think it's the job itself is ripe with the opportunity for corruption. Narcotics, for instance, sometimes a policeman's out there for X number of years, and he sees dope dealers prospering. They're arrested. They're arrested, prosecuted, beat the case. They're back out in the street. They're very affluent. And sometimes I think some policemen that don't have the right frame of mind start thinking that the system's working against them, and they fall subject to corruption.
Mm. There's an officer in your book, Gina, who was your field training officer. You call him Vaughn.
Right.
Was he a bad cop, a lazy cop, or both?
I think he was probably dictated by fear. I think his behavior was governed by fear, and that made him become lazy just because it was easier not to do anything than to actually extend himself. I was very lucky in that even though I had him as a training officer, and Dennis will tell you, any cop will tell you that the person that you start out in your early days with is the person who influences you most. You learn from them. You model yourself after them, however unconsciously. And so I was very lucky, even though I worked with him, and he really set an awful example, that I worked with enough good cops to pick up on their examples and understand what it was that good cops really did. I think the other thing, in responding to your last question, in addition to the situations that set up, like narcotics, that might tempt some cops that are prone to that in any case, I think there's also the response from the public. I think a lot of the public expect cops to be crooked. When you make a traffic stop and they take out their license, they'll hand you a 20 with it. Or if you go in, you're investigating a bar situation, and you've gotten a call where they might be serving a minor, and you go in there, the bar owner will come and shake your hand, and he's just passed you a $100 bill. You know, how many cops are there? Now, and this is a rhetorical question. In my experience, when I handed it back, they looked at me like I was from Mars, and then it became a sexist issue, like, oh, well, you can't pay off women. And no, it's not the case. You can't pay off anybody who's out there doing their job. doing what they're supposed to do. But people just expect it as a matter of course that if you have the money, you can pay off a cop and you can money talks, you can really get anything you want. And there are some people that are out there, some police that are out there that I think at some point think, well, what's the harm? If it's offered and nobody knows, what is the harm? And I'm not saying that that's generally what's done. I'm just saying that it happens.
Hmm. I think there was a report they called the Knapp Commission report on police corruption issued years ago, and they referred to police corruption to police officers that are prone to corruption as grass eaters and meat eaters. And grass eaters were police officers that may accept a cup of coffee or may accept a $5 gratuity for one reason or another. The meat eaters were guys that were actually criminal. But in defense of the police department on the whole, I would like to say that in my 30 years, wherever those guys were at, I did not see it. They constitute a very, very small percentage of police officers.
Hmm. How good is the police department in terms of policing its own?
I think they're overly critical of policing their own, to be honest with you. A policeman on a daily basis, police officers confront, I couldn't even venture a guess at how, you know, different officers confront a different number of people in different situations, you know, executing narcotic search warrants, interrogations, traffic stops, the officers that assign traffic duties or patrol duties, and very few people, when we stop them, it's a happy situation. I mean, it's always a confrontational situation. Nobody likes to get a ticket. Nobody likes to get arrested. And there's a large percentage of those cases, complaint registers are issued against the police officers for one thing or another. Either they didn't announce their office executing the search warrant, or excessive force is very often cited. For a traffic violation, they didn't commit the traffic violation, or they were disrespectful to the citizen they stopped. And an overwhelming number of those cases, the allegation is sustained against the police officer. And there's some type of reprimand, which I think is detrimental to the overall effectiveness of the unit, because every time a policeman stops somebody and a complaint is registered and it's sustained by the Internal Affairs Division or the Office of Professional Standards, obviously that policeman is less reluctant to do his job the next day. Not cost-effective.
The other problem is that people become street smart in dealing with the police, and they realize that if they sue the department, an incident that occurs, you know, what is a confrontation with the police can become a cash cow if litigation follows. Mm-hmm. In my book, I wrote about a shooting that I had on my fourth day on the street after getting out of the academy.
Mm-hmm.
And the person that I shot was someone who had a long list of felony charges, had been in and out of jail for years. And I'm talking about this. These are not light offenses. This was aggravated battery, aggravated rape, armed robbery, home invasions. He was not a nice man. Plus, he had just carved up his sister, who wanted him dead, who wished him dead, who told me to kill him, actually. And after he pointed a gun in my face as well as butcher knives, when I finally did shoot him, when the mother and sister came to identify the body, the mother said without a tear in her eye, well, he never was any good. He should have been dead a long time ago.
This was also a guy who, the way you tell the story, Gina, is that it seems like he was also waiting for you, and he was going to kill you.
Right. Right, absolutely. And, well, he said, you better shoot me because I'm going to blow your head off. And when the family came to identify the body, there was just no remorse, no tears, no anything. And then the following week, I got word that they were suing me for wrongful death and police misconduct and excessive use of force, and they were suing the police department. And the corporation counsel of the department ended up settling on a court for over $2 million. Now, this happens all the time. It happens not obviously not in that magnitude all the time, because the police don't go around shooting people capriciously. But for a traffic stop or for an arrest when they say that they've been manhandled or their excessive force was used, they know that if they lodge a complaint, they can sue the department, and the department calls them nuisance suits because there's so many of them, because it's become a trend, and they'll just settle out of court. Dennis has a good story about nuisance suits and people during arrests.
Yeah, they have, they're settling out of court. You know, it's less expensive for the city to settle a case, regardless of whether the police officer was right or wrong. It's less expensive for them to settle it out of court than it is to try the case. And like Gina said, they're called nuisance cases. So even though there's no substance, and the Corporation Council and the city recognizes that, they make the settlement payment. They offer them a settlement payment. And the reason the policemen don't like that is because now it looks as if there's a future lawsuit against you, now it looks as if you have done something wrong, that you were the subject of a suit prior, and which cost the city X number of dollars, or the city settled, and it looked like you were wrong in that suit. I had a case where I arrested a guy. When I was in the DEA task force, I arrested him for federal narcotics violations, and the guy resisted arrest, and I had to forcibly subdue him, and he had to turn himself in to the federal authorities in four more days on a previous conviction, and he was going to prison. So he went to prison on the case that we had worked. He went to prison, and while he was in there, he tried to file suit against me for excessive force in effecting his arrest. And as I understand that, he couldn't get an attorney to represent him. They wouldn't take the case because the force was justified. So he went to prison for 2 years, and when he got out of prison 2 years later, he filed suit himself. He took his jailhouse lawsuit course, and he filed the suit himself, and the city settled with him.
In the long run, then, is it, for everybody concerned, is it more expensive for these suits to be settled than to be litigated? I mean, you're looking at a number of costs in terms of morale, in terms of setting this trend, and so on and so forth.
Well, the city and the police departments are businesses, and they don't look at it from cost of morale. They look at it in strictly dollars and cents. It's less expensive to settle it out of court on these cases they call nuisance cases that are going to be settled for $5,000 or $10,000. Obviously, like Gina, in some of these cases, if it's a wrongful death suit, the attorneys, no one is reluctant to do it because they ask for astronomical amounts of money. They just did one recent Chicago case where they awarded, $13 million or something, I forget what the amount was. But, the city may not settle that out of court. As a matter of fact, that case, they did settle out of court. But some of those cases, they may take the trial if they think it's cost-effective to go to trial and roll the dice and see how they come out. But on most of these nuisance cases, I said suits are filed against. I could not tell you how many lawsuits I had against me in my 30 years. It's just common. It's the cost of doing business, you know.
Well, how do you keep your perspective over 30 years' time?
Perspective as far as what?
How do you, keep doing the job?
Well, you have to love the job.
Yeah.
And that's, most policemen, Gene and I, when we do some of these seminars and presentations, we're often asked the same question. I tell you, there are a number of policemen. We have policemen that are, that have law degrees, that are lawyers. They have master's degrees in education, and they're policemen. They've in some cases they've left a job and went into family businesses. They've left the police department and went into more lucrative professions. But somewhere along the line, they miss it. They come back. They give up their lucrative. We just had one cadet just came to Gina, our last book signing. He joined the Chicago Police Department when he was 62 years old. He got out. He was a very successful businessman. When he retired from his career, he joined the police department. He went through the police academy as a cadet, as a recruit when he was 62 years old, and was assigned to the Inglewood Police District. And he had to retire 4 months after he was on the job. But it was something that he'd always wanted to do, and, you know, he certainly didn't need the money.
Well, and going through the police academy, that's not
that's rough.
Easy. I know from reading Gina's book. That's tough.
Yeah, no, it's like boot camp, you know. Yeah. And when he came to our signing, we asked him, as a matter of fact, Gina asked him. I wouldn't ask him, but Gina did.
I have no tact.
Gina said, listen, wasn't that academy a little hard for you going through there? And he said that he'd always been a runner. You know, he said he'd always been a runner, and the only part that was really difficult for him, you know, he said, so the running was not difficult for him. He says he could keep up with the younger guy. He said he may not have been as fast. He said, but he could run to 6 miles a day.
Mm. And that wall, Gina?
the wall is still there. It's still in place. But he said that he didn't really have a lot of problems with the wall or the defensive tactics.
Yeah, no, he was in pretty good physical condition.
Yeah. You have to be.
But yeah. When he left here, he was forced to retire. He was sent to Inglewood, and I know for people who are not from Chicago, that you know that doesn't mean anything to them. Inglewood is one of the toughest police districts in the city. In fact, doesn't he have the most the highest crime stats then of any of the districts except two?
Well, at one point it even had higher a higher crime rate than the second district. The Inglewood Police District. I was a watch commander in Inglewood for about 6 years, and it was the highest crime rate in the city at that time. And I was on vacation. I was in Cancun, and I met these kids from Canada there, and we started talking, and they found out, you know, I was a police officer, and the one girl asked me what I did, and I told her I was the watch commander in the Inglewood Police District. And she said, how many murders did you have there? And I said, we've had about 92. And she turned around to her friends and she said, see, I told you. She said, we had almost that many murders in Canada.
Mm.
And I said, I'm not talking about it in the United States. I said, I'm talking about mm-hmm. in a police district in Chicago. I said, I'm talking about a 2-mile by 2-mile area. And, you know, that's, I forget how many murders Inglewood had for that year, but, you know, in Chicago, I think in 1974 was still our highest murder year, highest homicides.
So,
I think it was 743 or something. But for every person that was shot and succumbed to the injuries, there were multiply that number by 20, and that's how many people were shot in the city.
Mm.
You know, most of them lived.
And our 62-year-old recruit, what forced him into retirement?
His age. They made him take a mandatory retirement, much to his regret. So he just went back to his business where he's making money hand over fist, but he misses the police department.
At 62, that's the mandatory age?
63,
okay. And before we move on to the next topic of conversation, I want to give folks who are listening an idea of what the wall is. Gina, you want to... The wall at the academy.
When you enter... When you enter the academy, you, in addition to all of the written work that you're responsible for, you have to take physical training and defensive tactics. Part of the physical training requirements are state-mandated that you have to complete a 3-mile run within a certain period of time, and you have to complete an obstacle course. And one of the things on the obstacle course is a 6-foot, 6-inch wall that is completely smooth, that has no footholds whatsoever. It's made out of polished pine. And at the top of it, there's a strip of AstroTurf, which is supposed to give you traction. But for all the women who don't take the wall the way the guys do, and usually the guys just run up to it, vault it, and flip over, the women usually run up to it and try to grab on with their arms and pull themselves over because they don't necessarily have the upper body strength. And when you hit that wall, you hit the top of the wall and the AstroTurf with your arms or your forearms, you shred your skin. So for the length of time that you're in the academy and you're trying to go over that wall, you either have no skin at all on the undersides of your arms or you have huge purple bruises.
Not easy. What's the average length of service in the department?
I don't know. The saying is 30 years of vaudeville, then retire with a pension. So I
would say between 25 and 30 years.
Yeah.
Oh. I've been told that there are a lot of officers reaching retirement age now in the Chicago Police Department, and that there is a great need for recruits at this point. Is that the case?
Offhand, I would say yes. At one point, several years ago, we were the oldest police department in the country, with a median age of 42 years old. Now they've since rehired they've since hired a lot of personnel, but at one time we were baby boomer heavy, and I think for the most part they're retiring. It's a younger department than it was then, but I think they're always still looking for good personnel.
And the thing that's changed now than from what it was previously is that they've changed their hiring criteria. They're looking for people now with more education. Before, you could have graduated high school, and you could come on the job at 21, and that's changed now. They're looking for people with at least a minimum of 2 years of college, and I think the age now is 23. I think what they really want to do is change that to 4 years of college and have a degree, but I think that's going to be a problem in recruiting, because people that have a four-year degree might not be as motivated to join a department where the starting salary would be considerably less than if they went into private business or industry.
Hmm. Are women and minorities gaining a greater acceptance in the department, Jean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I am really happy to say that glass ceiling has been eliminated now. We now have women that are in the upper echelons of the police department in supervisory capacity. So, yeah, that has changed a lot. Just in the past 10 years, it's changed quite a bit.
Dennis Banahan, you signed on to the force in 1969. That must have been a hell of a year to sign on to the Chicago
Police. That was a hell of a year to sign on. It just gotten over the 68th Democratic Convention. It was a very volatile year, and a lot of the violence in that particular area was not only was it violent, but a lot of it was directed at the police. A friend of mine, one of the guys was training with me the first month I was on. His name was John Gilhooly. But John Gilhooly was ambushed, and he was shot to death before I was on the job my first month. And in that same incident, another police officer named Frank Rappaport was shot to death, and there were several other policemen that were shot that survived the incident but were permanently disfigured. And on the 3rd of March in 1970, the first year anniversary that I was on the job, another friend of mine, Tommy Kelly, was shot to death. And his partner sustained 5 gunshot wounds in the chest but survived the incident. And the early 70s, 2 officers assigned to the Cabrini Green Project's vertical patrol unit, Severin and Rosado, were shot to death. And it was really volatile. It was a violent era, and a lot of it was directed toward the police.
Why did you want to become a Chicago police officer?
My brother was a Chicago police officer, and I guess I just wanted to follow in his footsteps.
And, Gina, you followed in your father's.
Yeah, but I didn't want to. And I want to go on record as saying that I had no intention ever of becoming the police, and I come from a police family. My dad and 5 uncles were police officers, so when I joined the job, I thought I had no illusions whatsoever. I thought I'd heard everything, seen anything, heard all their stories, and that's completely wrong. I mean, for anybody who goes on thinking that they know everything, they get a rude awakening in those first few days.
Your decision was an economic one.
Right, and people have to read the book to get the real story. But, yeah, it was. And I always thought that it was an interim job, and that as soon as I found something better in my own field, I would return to that. But once I started, once I got on the street, I knew that there was never anything else that I would ever do.
Except write.
Well, how is it that the two of you picked up pens and started writing? How quickly after retirement did you start writing?
I actually wrote my my book before I retired.
Okay.
A friend of mine named Hugh Holton, who just recently passed away. Holton was still on the job at the time of his death. He was a captain in the 2nd District. But Hugh Holton had written a novel in 1994, And his last novel was just released, what was it, a month ago?
Right.
His last novel was just released one month ago. His eighth novel was released 1 month ago, and he died the following week of cancer. But he was a friend of mine. We came on the job together in 1969. And I went to his first book signing that he had in downtown Chicago, and I thought as I was leaving of his with his book, I thought, you know, policemen are always saying that we have volumes and volumes of stories in our heads, and just nobody seems to really take the time to commit them to paper. And Holton did, and so I started writing mine. That's what started me.
And I've been writing, I really never started as an adult. I've been writing since I was a kid. And I wrote short stories all the way through my adulthood. And I never wrote anything police-related until I left. And probably what started me writing police-related work was that I remembered how it was, and this is true of any partner, any police partners on the street. Usually they'll encounter some call one night that's so ludicrous or so absurd or so strange, they'll look at each other and say, you know, one of these days we got to write a book about this. And the other partner will usually say, yeah, but who would ever believe it? Nobody would ever believe it. So I wrote the book. And you know what? Since that book has come out, since Armed and Dangerous has come out, I've gotten a lot of mail from people saying, I can't believe this, unless they're police. And then they say, you know, this is exactly what happened to me. And these are police that could be anywhere in the nation. And they're saying that they've had a similar experience, which tells you how universal a cop's experiences are.
Hmm. How did the two of you team up to write the column for Blue Murder, the online magazine?
Dan?
Okay. I had joined an organization called the Police Writers Association. And I was looking for assistance in, writing the novel and publishing outlets. And so I joined the Police Writers Association. It's online. And I was looking through their website to see if there was somebody there who could be of assistance. And I looked, and that year, the winner of their nonfiction award was Gina Gallo, who was a Chicago police officer. And the writer of their fictional award was Gina Gallo. And it was the first year since they'd been in operation that one author had ever won in both categories, you know, in the same year. So I thought this is kind of like the story about the guy that went around the world to find riches, and oil was in his backyard. So Gina lives about 15 minutes away from me, and I contacted her, and we started communicating back and forth, and then we started writing for Blue Murder.
What kind of topics do you write about in the column?
Basically, Blue Murder is a crime and mystery magazine, and it's fiction. They publish all fiction, and so in our column, we publish nonfiction true police stories, just about things that happen on the street, encounters that we've had, situations that people who do write crime think about, but they don't know what the real components of it are because they've never experienced it firsthand. So we give them the real story, and it's essentially like being in a car with two cops out on the street, being right there and seeing it as it unfolds.
And what's the title of the book of fiction that you wrote, Gina?
Oh, I didn't write a book of fiction. It's
okay.
Crime Scenes.
Okay.
Crime Scenes is a collection of short nonfiction police stories, but all of those were columns from Blue Murder.
Oh, okay.
So it's a collection of nonfiction stories, and it's kind of an extension of the kinds of things you'll find in Armed and Dangerous. It's just that Armed and Dangerous was in production for longer than was expected, and Dennis and I already had our book signing tour set up, and I had no books, so always a problem. So Blue Murder published a trade paperback of nonfiction short stories, and that came out right away, and that's what when we first started touring. That's the book that I had.
I see. Well, let's talk some more about what it's like to be a police officer in Chicago. Gina, in your book, Armed and Dangerous, you talk about getting ready to start the day. You wrote, when my workday starts, I become a uniform and an attitude.
Right. You know, I was a single parent the entire time that I was on the job, and I worked nights always for my entire career. And so I used to think what kind of effect it had on my kids, that other parents would be putting their children to bed, reading them stories, and I was strapping on a gun belt. And how, you know, how did that affect my kids? What long-term effect did it have? And when I went out on the street every night, they knew, because I told them, and they were very small at the time, they knew that there was a possibility that I might not come home. And they accepted that. I wanted them, I didn't want to sugarcoat anything, but I had to let them know that this is what real life is like, and this is also what comes from a criminal life. You know, and just as I might not come home, neither will the bad guy get to go home. So that was something that they had to grow up with. So when I went out on the street, I had to make sure that I got to go home to them, and I had to make sure that I walked the walk. And a big part of the job is attitude. If you allow yourself to go out there and look vulnerable, or if you don't have your game face on, which is something that I address in the book and refer to consistently throughout, the game face means that you have to suppress your feelings. It doesn't mean that you're not affected by what you experience, only that you don't allow it to show. Because if people see that you're vulnerable, it interferes with your ability to act as a police officer, and people will see you as weak and as a target. And I couldn't afford that, and none of us can.
Did you keep your game face on? Was that something that you could take off after a while?
With other police officers. And that's how it begins. You know, people say that cops have this elite little fraternity. It's really not that. It's not that, you know, we're the blue gang and you're not, so stay away from us. It's only that we see things and have experienced things and have been places that other people haven't, and they don't understand or don't want to understand. I think most people have a very low threshold for abhorrent situations, like when you drive past an accident scene. You know, of course, there's a gawker's a moment in time where everybody wants to stop and see what it is, but if they see anything too graphic, they're disgusted and they rush away. Police don't, because we have to be there. We have to be there when somebody pulls a gun in our face. We have to be there when we find the babies in the dumpsters. We can't walk away. And so other people who are not police and have not experienced these things will say, how can you do that? How can you go to work every day knowing that that's what you see? But the reality is that there's other things we see that make up for that. We see what it's like to deliver a baby, of a mother who's scared and can't make it to the hospital in time and has no money and is afraid for her life and her child's life. We see what it's like to hold somebody who's dying and know that we are the last face they will ever see on this earth before they go. You know, moments in time like that, you can't trade for anything.
Mm-hmm. So there are days when you go home feeling people are okay, they're basically good.
And you want to go back out there and do it again. And as Denny will tell you, we've talked about this many times, you know, a big part of the job is being Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, and the other percentage is being an adrenaline junkie.
Mm-hmm. Gina, have your kids shown any interest in becoming police officers?
Not at all.
Good.
No, not at all. Yeah. They've seen the reality of it, and they understand completely, but it's just not something that they're interested in. I'm happy to say that they're both very interested and have shown talent in writing, so I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah. Dennis, do you have children?
Yes, I do. And my son's a teacher in the Chicago public school system, and my daughter's a housewife.
Mm. Never shown any interest in becoming police officers?
My son almost did. He submitted an application. He had already been teaching for 5 or 6 years. And he submitted the application. He took the examination. He went for the physical. He went for the psychological, and he was ready to be called. And he said, you know, Dad. He said, I don't know if this is for me. He says, you know, I'm working for the Board of Education. He said, I work straight days. He said, I'll never work afternoons. He said, I'll never work midnights. Nobody will ever shoot at me. He said, I'm off every weekend. I'm off all holidays. He said, and I just don't know if I want to trade that in. He says, I told him, well, you got to do what you feel is right. You know, job isn't for everybody, and certainly police officers are, it's a 24/7 job. They're out there on Christmas and New Year's, and we're spending it settling other people's disputes, and our families are home without us. But somebody has to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So I could certainly understand his decision.
Yeah. I don't know if I think I'd have real mixed feelings if I was a parent of a child or children who wanted to become police officers. On one hand, I'd feel some pride. On the other hand, I'd worry like the devil.
Yeah, well, I was more worried like the devil.
Yeah.
Because I know what it's like out there, and I was really glad. I mean, I wouldn't have told him what to do one way or the other. He's 33 years old. He's a grown man. He has to make his own decisions. But I was really glad when he opted to stay with the Board of Education. Mm-hmm. Though I don't know that that's any safer than being a policeman.
That's a tough job, too.
Yes.
Very
yes,
tough. Our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, two veterans of the Chicago Police Department, Dennis Banahan and Gina Gallo, are our guests. Gina was a police officer for 16 years from 1982 to 1998. Dennis was a police officer for 30 years from 1969 to 1999. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. 333-WILL. Anywhere else outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk to a listener on the toll-free line in Eureka, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. A quite interesting conversation. As you were talking, I was thinking about what people have in their mind, and you were directing that, talking about a 24-hour day, 365-day-a-year job. I guess I'll go ahead and ask the question. What do you think are maybe the one or two biggest misconceptions the public at large has about what it's like to be in a policeman or a policewoman?
I'll go first, although we both have answers to this. People tend to categorize neighborhood or ethnic group according to what is most prone for a crime to be committed, and that is absolutely not true. There is no such thing as a good neighborhood. A crime is committed everywhere. It's not specific to an ethnic group. It's not specific to a socioeconomic group. It happens everywhere. And it can be just as brutal and bloody and heinous in a very well-to-do suburb as it can be in the inner city.
Dennis, from your point of view, what's the biggest misconception we have about police work?
Basically, I'd be in agreement with Gene. You know, when you're dealing with certain ethnic groups, one group always thinks that, regardless of who they are, they think that policemen are being unfair to them, and that you wouldn't enforce the laws of the job the same way you would in another area. And it's just not true. If you're in any kind of demonstration, regardless of what it is, if you're out there and there's a gay parade and the police are assigned to maintain order, once there is disorder, the crowd seems to think that it's directed at being gay, and it's not. If it was African American or Hispanic or Irish American, whatever it was, when the police are there, no one likes to be constrained, and that's what our job is to maintain order.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Are the two of you fans of police shows?
I don't watch police shows ever.
Yeah.
No, I rarely do.
Yeah. Now, Gina, I understand from my producer, Harriet Williamson, that a couple of film companies have shown interest in your book.
Right. They're talking about either a series or a movie for Armed and Dangerous. And it should be interesting because I've been told not to get excited about anything, of course, because everybody can talk. But, until you actually see the finished project, who knows what will really happen. But I've also been warned that the translation from real life to Hollywood can sometimes be tripping the fantastic. They have to sensationalize it or fictionalize it for Hollywood purposes, mm-hmm. to glamorize it. And that's probably why most police don't watch any police or crime shows on TV, or if they do, very rarely, because they're so unrealistic.
I think if you remember, there was a movie called The Choir Boys. The book The Choir Boys was written by Joe Wambaugh in the LAPD, but he was so upset when they made it into a movie, I guess, that he didn't even watch it. I don't know if he filed suit or not, but they distorted the book and almost made it look like it was a comedy, and it wasn't intended to, you know, to be that way.
So, Gina, if the book is sold to a film company, will you try to keep a hand in?
That'll be part of the negotiations for creative control. Absolutely.
You're going to make me the handsome, good-looking star?
That's right.
Thank you, Gina.
Any interest in Threshold of Pain?
Yes, I. People that were involved with making the U.S. Marshals and Code of Silence and what was the other? The Fugitive had shown some interest in it, but I haven't heard anything back, so still up in the air.
Hmm. Are you at work on another book?
Me or Gina?
Both of you. But
okay, I'll go
one
for
at
it.
A time.
Yes, I'm writing a sequel to Threshold of Pain called Bad Juju.
And Gina?
I have one that's one is a novel called Murder in Glass Houses, and then a follow-up to Armed and Dangerous, which is called Sworn Secrets.
Hmm. And Dennis, tell us just a little bit about Threshold of Pain.
Threshold of Pain starts in 1968. The police department had it was the intelligence unit. There was never anything called the Red Squad in the police department, but that's what it became known as. In the newspapers and the media, they referred to the unit as the Red Squad. But it was kind of a municipal CIA, and they were used to investigate dissidents and subversive organizations during that time. And they were banned in 1983 by the federal court. They were told to cease all practices, and the unit was disbanded. In this book, like I said, it's fictional. And starts in 1968 with two undercover police officers assigned to that unit. And one of them is a photographer for the unit. And he accidentally stumbles upon some information that may involve a University of Chicago law student with the assassinations of King and Kennedy. And though everybody believes that it's too incredulous to warrant further investigation, he launches an investigation, and it appears that the FBI is stonewalling his investigation. And starts out almost as a investigative curiosity, turns into a 22-year odyssey. And we have a love interest in there, and some political theory, conspiracy theories, a few murders.
And a good soundtrack.
And a good soundtrack.
Speaking of the Red Squad, which you said that's what it was termed in the press, what's your biggest beef with the media?
My biggest beef with the media is just that they distort the facts. You know, sometimes especially when I was in homicide, their coverage sometimes of a homicide investigation, I don't know where they got their information from or how they got their information, but it wasn't remotely similar to. I'd almost have to read it to find out whether or not they're talking about the same murder I was working on. You know, they just distorted the facts.
Yeah, they don't rely on the truth. They don't let the truth get in the way of them writing an article.
Yeah.
Celeste, if I may, can I do our commercial?
You're doing a commercial?
Yeah, I'm doing a commercial right now.
Yeah.
Dennis's book is Threshold of Pain is published by Rutledge Press.
Uh-huh.
My book, Armed and Dangerous, Memoirs of a Chicago Policewoman, is published by Forge Press.
Uh-huh.
And my second book, Crime Scenes, is published by Blue Murder Press. All of those books will be available at Pages for All Ages in Savoy, Illinois, and anywhere else, actually, any other bookstore if you want to ask for it. And if you would like to find out more about me and where Dennis and I will be appearing next, you can go to my website, and that is gallostories.com. It's G-A-L-L-O, stories, all one word. .com.
Okay. Well, maybe one of these days you'll come down here and visit us.
Well, we plan on that. Since the books weren't available this time, we're gonna make a return trip real soon.
Okay. Take care of the two of you.
Thank you very much. This is a pleasure.
Gina Gallo and Dennis Banahan have been our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Both are retired officers from the Chicago Police Department who are now writing.